From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. It has been a busy week in Georgia politics. A new governor sworn in, new legislative session underway in the House and Senate. Now leaders are rallying support for their agendas. Republican Governor Brian Kemp delivered his first State of the State address yesterday.
Last year, the legislature lowered the state income tax rates and fully funded public school education. I'm confident that we can do it again.
GPB Politics reporter Stephen Fowler is taking a break from the Capitol to join us in the studio. Good morning.
Good morning, Virginia.
Stephen, the week began with the inauguration of Governor Brian Kemp and other lawmakers. Kemp did sign a trio of executive orders on his first day. What did they involve?
So Monday was a busy day. Kemp had a private prayer service with his family, then was sworn in as Georgia's 83rd governor, and lastly had a review of troops. And after that, he did sign these three executive orders. One creates something called the Georgians First Commission, which is going to spend the next year and a half or so looking at ways to improve small business opportunities and laws and frameworks, cut red tape, basically. One is another thing that Governor Deal had before, which was a state ethics policy for the executive branch, no gifts, things like that. And the last one dealt with sexual harassment. It creates a unified sexual harassment policy for all of the different state branches of government and all of the different departments and things like that. One of the things it does is creates a inspector position, or kind of each department has to have a male and a female who will investigate claims of sexual harassment. And all of it is funneled up to the State Office of Inspector General, who will have to oversee all sorts of cases of sexual harassment, as opposed to each department kind of handling it internally.
And as I understand it, the state Senate made its own changes regarding sexual harassment. What happened there?
So also on Monday, when the state Senate first gaveled in, they passed some rules changes, kind of internal rules of how they operate, different things like that. And they went the opposite direction with sexual harassment. They put a time limit and a window in which somebody can accuse a senator or a staffer in the Senate of sexual harassment. Previously, it was indefinitely. Now it's 2 years. And there were some other things, like if you file a complaint, you cannot make it public. Otherwise, that complaint gets dismissed and you could be fined.
So a record number of female lawmakers are in the state legislature and U.S. Congress right now. 2018, of course, called the Year of the Woman. But female senators in Georgia say they don't have equal access to power. Here is Republican State Senator Renee Unterman speaking on Monday.
Ladies of the Senate, we are not the pitcher. We're not the first baseman. We're not the second baseman. We're not the third baseman. I played shortstop. We're not the shortstop people. We're not even in the outfield. As a matter of fact, we're not even in the ballpark. We're outside, and we're outside looking over a fence, and we're climbing that fence, and we're trying to look into the ball field to see who's playing.
Senator Unterman, she is a former nurse, by the way, was ousted as head of the Senate Health and Human Services Committee. Now, who makes decisions on who serves on or heads committees?
Well, so there's a Senate Committee on Assignments, which is one of the committees in the Senate. And it's right now it's male lawmakers that decided who gets to be the chair, the vice chair, the secretary, and on each of these committees. And there are 27 committees in the Senate. Four of them right now are headed by women, which is up from two during the last legislative session. But now one thing that Unterman said, and several of her Democratic colleagues came to say, is that even though four women headed up those Senate committees, most of those committees didn't have any real actual power. Senator Unterman, when she was chair of the Health and Human Services Committee, said that she saw 121 bills during that committee in the last session, and she was moved to chair the Science and Technology Committee, which only saw three. So there's a big disparate proportional amount of what the committees see. And Senator Elena Parent, a Democrat from Atlanta, came on and said that most eight of the nine committees that she saw that passed the most bills were chaired by men and had overrepresentation of men and underrepresentation of women.
So besides tightening up on how sexual harassment claims can be filed within the Senate, Sounds like there are some complaints within the female leadership, and it's been building since the beginning of the week. Unterman is not the only one who's angry. Who is standing beside her on this?
Well, so what you had on the Senate floor earlier this week was you had Senator Unterman come up and speak, Senator Parent, Senator Freddie Powell Sims. You had a series of female senators from old hands to newly elected senators come in and share their stories and share their perspective about the expertise they had, and maybe it wasn't used on this commission. Senator Jen Jordan, who we heard at the top of the show, said, if you're going to put me in charge of a committee, she was put in charge of a committee and said she was proud until she found out that committee only saw six bills and said, if you're going to stick me somewhere and not use my skill set, shame on you. So it was a bipartisan issue. It was a female issue. And other male senators did come up and say this isn't right as well. So it's a sticking point in the Senate.
And those who defended, is this along party line?
Well, Lieutenant Governor Jeff Duncan released a statement saying that it's a difficult process deciding who goes on these committees, consensus builders, people who have expertise, et cetera, and things like that. And any notion that there was any sort of bias or anything in there was nonsense. And another Republican Senator, Jeff Mullis, came up and said basically that Democrats did similar things when they were in power and people should stop whining about committee assignments.
How about over in the State House? Are we seeing the wave of women shaking things up there?
Well, the State House does not have new leadership. Republican House Speaker David Ralston has been there a while. He runs a tight ship. People respect his leadership style. And there are a lot more people and a lot more committees, and it's a lot more representative of the makeup of Georgia than the smaller state Senate.
Speaking with GPB politics reporter Stephen Fowler, he's been down at the state capitol most days following all things political and bringing them back to us at GPB. Yesterday, Governor Brian Kemp did deliver his first State of the State address 4 days in. What did he have to say?
Well, Brian Kemp got his start as a builder working in constructions and things. So all of his speeches this week have had a theme about building. Yesterday, he opened up with a parable of two builders from the Bible. There was one builder who built a house upon a rock and another built it on sand. When the rain came, the one with the sand washed away. He says Georgia is built on a rock. And there are a lot of things going right with the economy and with unemployment being low and things like that. But he said there are certain areas that need to improve, like small businesses that he mentioned, rural healthcare, rural Georgia, and our education system. And he wants to make sure that all of those are fixed and that more people want to continue to come to Georgia.
So in that bill, he proposed his budget. How does that deviate from the last spending plan under former Governor Deal?
Well, one of the things that former Governor Deal did in his final year was fully fund the state's education formula. That's something that Governor Kemp says he wants to continue. But there's some other educational proposals that Kemp made on the campaign trail that now he's put into this proposed budget. The biggest is a $3,000 raise for teachers and also a 2% raise for state employees and other school people like bus drivers and nurses and things like that. That's a huge chunk of change. In the budget, that item is about $491 million is what it would cost to do that raise for teachers. Now, on the campaign trail, he promised $5,000, but he said it's a good down payment on that process in this next year. So the education's the big thing. School safety is another thing. There's money in there for a one-time grant for every school in Georgia to have $30,000 to upgrade security as they see fit. And he said school safety and security and education is also tied into mental health. So there's positions for mental health counselors at public high schools in Georgia.
How are budget writers responding to this?
Well, the Georgia Budget and Policy Institute, which is a nonpartisan group looking at the budget, has a lot of thoughts about how things will be paid for or not paid for or what's in there. Education groups are very pleased with this focus on education. There are a lot of people eager to see how that $491 million is going to magically appear to pay for these things. But since the budget came out 4 days into Governor Kemp's tenure and there's budget hearings all next week, there's going to be a lot of people diving in deep, myself included, to figure out what's different, what's the same, and who's going to pay for it.
What's the response been from Democrats so far?
Well, the Democrats did hold a response to the state of the state last night. Senator Harold Jones of Augusta applauded Kemp for things like education, but said there needs to be step further. So they have proposals like a $15 minimum wage and a student loan payment program, saying that there needs to be need-based financial aid programs in Georgia. And one of the things that Governor Kemp proposed was $500,000 for this anti-gang task force. Now, in the state of the state response from the Democrats, they said, this is good, we need to target this, but be careful in how you frame it and phrase it so it's not predatory and so it's not negative to like the African-American community and other groups, and that it really does focus on the criminal justice reform aspect of the gang issue.
Now we're down to just 36 days for lawmakers. First four just pretty much flew by. Not heard much about actual legislation. What are leaders going to do to prioritize getting things done?
Well, both leaders of the House and Senate spoke earlier this week at the Georgia Chamber's Eggs and Issues Breakfast and kind of outlined their plans, some of the big things. Rural Georgia, we've got proposals for expanding broadband access, expanding rural health care. We have the school safety issues and the school teacher pay issues. And one of the things that is kind of mentioned around there is $150 million for new voting machines and a new voting system. That's something that's going to take a lot of time for lawmakers to figure out what exactly they want to do, how they want to change election law. And that's going to take a lot of time and a lot of political capital to get it done, because it's not like signing a bill saying, OK, we're going to give this money here. You've got to completely rewrite the way election code works. So that's something to watch for.
Well, I know you will be keeping a close eye on that. GBB Politics reporter Stephen Fowler.
Thank you.
It was the laws of nature that guided beloved poet Mary Oliver. The Pulitzer Prize winner died yesterday at the age of 83. Her accessible poetry celebrated small, sacred moments, often discovered on walks in the woods near her home on Cape Cod and later in Florida. Here's On Second Thought producer Elena Rivera reading Oliver's poem, In Blackwater Woods.
Look, the trees are turning their own bodies into pillars of light, are giving off the rich fragrance of cinnamon and fulfillment. The long tapers of cattails are bursting and floating away over the blue shoulders of the ponds, and every pond, no matter what its name is nameless now. Every year, everything I have ever learned in my lifetime leads back to this. The fires and the black river of loss, whose other side is salvation, whose meaning none of us will ever know. To live in this world, you must be able to do three things. To love what is mortal, to hold it against your bones, knowing your own life depends on it, and when the time comes to let it go, to let it go.
That's On Second Thought producer Elena Rivera reading Mary Oliver's poem, In Blackwater Woods. Oliver died yesterday at the age of 83 from lymphoma. She'd written some poems about Georgia. Unfortunately, too long for us to read today, but just a little glimpse there of her life and poetry. She's a woman who said she was living her life as a bride wedded to wonder. Coming up, a new documentary alleging sexual exploitation of young women by R. Kelly has stirred up a mix of responses and album sales. The FBI says related cases in Atlanta are all too common. We're going to hear from somebody who works in the area with women who have been through this, dealing with the responses to trauma and their lasting effects. I'm Virginia Prescott. You can learn more when On Second Thought continues after a short break. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. The Lifetime documentary series Surviving R. Kelly details accusations that the musician sexually exploited minors and young women.
I felt like my silence allowed it to continue. I worked up the courage to come forward and tell my story.
A part of me always felt like maybe I did something for him to treat me that way.
I want my story to be heard so people could take this situation seriously.
But when I found out it wasn't just me,
I just don't want it to get any worse.
While the allegations against R. Kelly are shocking, they are not isolated. The FBI says in Atlanta says it is one of the highest rates of child exploitation and trafficking in the country. Jennifer Frisco Bartle sees the lasting effects of these crimes every day. She's director of residential and clinical programs at Wellspring Living, which provides trauma-informed care and residential programs for female survivors of sexual abuse and exploitation. She's joining us in the studio. Jennifer, welcome.
Good morning.
So for people who have not seen the R. Kelly documentary, can you briefly tell us what kinds of allegations we're talking about?
Allegations of childhood sexual abuse, rape, statutory rape, sex with minors, and child pornography.
It's an unbelievably shocking story. And one of the allegations entails that he held women against their will, some of them teenagers, in houses in Chicago, in Atlanta. It's described as almost cult-like. Is that a technique that perpetrators use?
Absolutely. What it ends up looking like is Stockholm Syndrome. And what we call in our field is a trauma bond. So he has created relationships with people where he's used his position of power to make them feel as though they don't have a choice. I imagine the doors aren't locked. I imagine they can leave if they want to, which is why he's been able to skate by and avoid kidnapping charges. But he has brainwashed them to the point that they feel as though they have to stay.
And you heard one of those young women say, I figured it must have been me. So they think they belong there on some level?
Absolutely. They feel as though they have to stay. They owe him something, that they would be disappointing him if they left. He has really, in a sophisticated manner, removed any choice or any agency that they think they have.
Now, one of the places R. Kelly is accused of holding young women is in Metro Atlanta. What is it about this city that may have made that an option?
I think it could happen in any city. And I just imagine that he found a space here. There's a large music industry presence here, and he was doing work here, needed a home. I believe he had several homes. I think that trafficking happens in every city, in every state in the country. And unfortunately, regardless of what city you live in, if it's a large metropolitan city like Atlanta or a more rural city, for many different reasons, we don't see it when it's happening right in front of us, and it then becomes kind of easy to look away or imagine that it's not happening.
But do these issues show up in Georgia in ways that they may not in other places?
Definitely. This is a large metropolitan city, Atlanta. We have the busiest airport. We have sports teams, convention center. So there are lots of reasons for people to come through Atlanta, and it's ripe for people to want to participate in what we call sex tourism.
That's often the way that we think of it, right? That we think of sexual exploitation and trafficking of minors, maybe putting sex workers on the street. But there's a lot more going on. So what are some of the other forms that it does take?
It actually doesn't happen much on the street anymore. Most of it happens online, and it's prearranged. So when people come here for sexual tourism, they've arranged what they're looking for in a sexual experience with the traffickers before they get here.
I think a lot of people who watch that documentary and hearing stories like this could be asking, you know, how could this happen? And can you help flesh that out? What are some of the ways that perpetrators lure young women into these kind of situations?
It's often a person of power. So in R. Kelly's instance, I mean, these girls thought he was a god. They thought that he was doing them a favor by allowing them to even be in his presence. But it doesn't have to be that sophisticated, and you don't have to be a celebrity. You just have to be somebody that knows how to take advantage of somebody's vulnerabilities.
How about witnesses, though? Family and friends?
I think that we don't want to believe that this happens. We can't imagine that somebody would take advantage of someone, a child or an adult, in that way. And it's a little bit nuanced. So when it looks as though they have a choice to leave, we can be judgmental. We often, just as humans, tend to blame the victim. If your purse snatched, we don't say, I'm sorry that happened to you. We say, why did you have your purse in your buggy? You should have been paying better attention.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's also the well-worn image of who is being exploited. And one juror who was quoted in the Lifetime series argued he didn't consider young Black women to be victims because of the way they, quote, dressed and acted. Now, Georgia Cares, that's the state coordinating agency supporting child survivors of sex trafficking and exploitation, they found that over half of the survivors they worked with over just the last year were young women or young girls of color. How do these perceptions of race play into that victim blaming?
I think that that is an excellent point. It's easier for us to turn a blind eye to groups that we feel are marginalized, that don't look like us, that don't represent us. And so if you can put somebody into a category of other, it makes it easier for you to think, well, that can't happen to me, can't happen to my kids. And maybe because we have this construct of what a young Black woman should look like or should act like or is for sexually, then what things happen to her are probably her fault.
So, but I think there's often the other case is made that so many young women are sexualized in our culture. So it's not just young women of color, but you said if they don't look or act like us. So we're looking again at the predominating culture looking at the other.
It's absolutely the other. Yep.
Class dynamics are also involved in situations like this. So how does that, the socioeconomic or the poverty play into that?
Well, all of those things play into it. It really is a social justice issue. So you have the other of being female. So you've got gender. You have the other of being raised in poverty or having to go without. Oftentimes, kids that we work with say the way that they were recruited or introduced was somebody bought them a meal. So if your needs aren't being met, it's easy then for somebody to come in and offer you what they think you need. Then you feel like you owe them, and then they get you to do something that you might not want to do. So you put race and gender and class, and then you add in sometimes LGBTQ status. You have a group of people that we can just put in this other category that we don't have to pay attention to.
Is there a particular risk for LGBTQ youth?
Youth who are LGBTQ identified and particularly transgendered youth are at an increased risk for being trafficked. Transgender youth in Atlanta looking for jobs, looking for places to work. And if they are in the process of transitioning, oftentimes it's difficult for them to find jobs. And they begin to feel that the only work for them is sex work.
Well, the Fulton County District Attorney's Office is investigating a Metro Atlanta case related to R. Kelly. Mother and father say that their daughters got caught up with R. Kelly and that they haven't heard from the young women in years. How do perpetrators isolate their victims in this way? As you say, you know, even when the door may not be locked.
Isolation is key. If the perpetrator can remove you from any other perspectives other than the one that he or she wants you to have, you begin to think that they're the only voice of reason. Also, there's a lot of shame and stigma associated with the things that go on in human trafficking and sex work and transactional sex relationships. So young people begin to feel further and further removed from their family the more they're in it and the more that they are isolated from those other perspectives. So they begin to believe if their perpetrator tells them, your family won't take you back. You can't go back to a regular high school and go to prom and be a regular kid because you're forever different now.
Who was protecting him?
All of the adults around him. I also would believe and suggest that the people that continue to buy his music, the people that continue to support him, the people that continue to say, to separate who he is as an artist from what he does as a human. So in the documentary, they talked about R. Kelly versus Robert Kelly being two different people, same people, and the music bears that out.
I'm speaking with Jennifer Frisco Bartle. She's director of residential and clinical programs at Wellspring Living. Well, let's get into that a little bit because there's this movement, Mute R. Kelly, created by Black women, popularized by a Twitter hashtag. They argue that for a full boycott of the artist and his music, we know that Lady Gaga pulled her collaborations with him from streaming platforms, so did Chance the Rapper. Bethany Walker Branch and Kurt Reynolds, they had a conversation about this for Atlanta's Next Gen Radio.
I was an R. Kelly fan coming up. Wholeheartedly, I mean, to be honest with you, probably wasn't until I actually did a very, very minor amount of research into the allegations against him that I realized, oh man, like this guy's a sicko.
Right.
And
right.
I never really knew that. So I feel, you know, if you do separate the artist from the art, you're essentially allowing someone to, you know, operate without any consequences.
So there's the hate the sin, love the sinner kind of idea in that support. Is listening to R. Kelly's music supporting him?
Absolutely. Absolutely. He is able to get away with what he does because he hasn't felt any pain. He hasn't lost anything. That he's had no consequences personally or professionally or legally.
So this week, R. Kelly's Essential Hits album landed on the Billboard 200 charts, doing well, seemingly in response to the documentary. Is there a backlash then to the backlash?
That's frightening for me. There's no denying that he is a talented artist, whether you like his music or not. However, I don't think you can separate the two. And we vote with what we spend our money on. So if we are saying, you know, I can listen to this music and he's benefiting from that, then he doesn't feel any loss. And so for people, you asked me earlier, you know, who's helping him? The adults that are around him, but it's the people that's buying his music. It's the people that continue to attend the concerts that are essentially saying without saying, whatever else you're doing off stage, it's either okay with me or I don't care.
Let's talk about the survivors here. You've spent more than 20 years working with women and children, now interact with survivors at Wellspring Living. How do they eventually get out of these abusive, traumatic environments?
Oftentimes the kids and the women that we work with, they don't recognize themselves as survivors or victims of human trafficking. That's a pretty big definition that we use to raise awareness of the issues. They think I was in a relationship with somebody who really cared about me. He took great care of me. All traffickers aren't men also. So she fed me. She provided me a place to stay. She was kinder to me than my own parents. So often those relationships that end up being really abusive and really manipulative, they don't recognize it as such until they've been removed from it. So they were isolated. In some ways, we need to isolate them from those manipulative relationships to get them to see, you know, maybe there is another way. Maybe that relationship that I thought was so helpful to me was actually really hurtful.
But once they get out of that psychological hold, I imagine there's a lot of work to do, you know, physically, emotionally, to heal. And with all of that shame, how do you at Wellspring and other organizations, for that matter, help them heal?
It starts with some psychoeducation about what trafficking is. So that's, again, a big word, but break it down to the smaller pieces so they recognize that that is, in fact, what happened to them. And then it starts with building them back up as a whole human with the things that they're interested in. So for kids, that's, what are you interested in school? We have kids who come to our school on campus in our program, and they say, I want to learn more. Can we have a language class? I want to be doing all these things that I missed out on when I wasn't in school. So these aren't kids to be thrown away. These are kids who want to thrive. In our women's program, we have women who say, I want a job. I want to work in an office. I want to work at Delta. I have other skills to offer besides my body. And I would like to make a living wage doing something meaningful.
So did the documentary open the door, do you think, for other victims to tell their stories? I mean, when it was released, several made memes and even jokes on social media online. Has this uncovered traumatic memories for other victims?
It's definitely, I think, been triggering for people to see what happened to them. Again, the shame and stigma serves to protect the perpetrator because we just don't talk about what happened to us. And now people are seeing, well, maybe if she can tell her story and she can go on TV and cry and talk about the really horrific things that happened, then maybe I could do the same thing.
Well, as you mentioned, you know, it's hard to wrap your head around the fact that his sales are booming But there have been arguments that I've seen bubbling up that white perpetrators of crimes like this are not chased down in the same way as high-profile black men like R. Kelly or like a Bill Cosby, for example, that just comes to mind. How do we navigate these conversations when there is also real harm to real people?
Right. So it's dangerous to throw the baby out with the bathwater, so to speak. So to say, because men of color tend to be perpetrated, tend to be prosecuted, tend to be incarcerated at much higher rates, that if somebody is doing something wrong, like Bill Cosby, like OJ, like R. Kelly, that we would turn the other way. So we can't have it both ways. So yes, we should be addressing the higher rates of incarceration and prosecution of people of color, particularly men of color. And there are men of color who are committing real crimes that need to be held accountable.
How about the perception? I mean, right now we're talking about saving victims. 20 years ago, prosecutors were still focused on throwing, you know, so-called prostitutes into prison. How has that changed?
We don't use that word anymore. If you can't consent for sex, you can't be a child prostitute. So we call that a victim of human trafficking, of sexual exploitation of children. So the laws are different now. Instead, if you are recovered with a buyer or with a trafficker, you get services, you get help instead of being blamed.
Jennifer Frisco Bartle, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
She's director of residential and clinical programs at Wellspring Living, helps provide trauma-informed care for female survivors of sexual abuse and exploitation. Coming up to the break, back with more on Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. We're bending our Georgia playlist rules today. Normally, we ask musicians and bands to pick two songs by Georgia-born or based artists. Today, we have three. Nelson Patton features Dave Nelson on looping trombone and Marlon Patton on drums and Moog bass pedals. The experimental duo's debut album, Along the Way, is out now, and they're performing with another musical innovator, D'Antoni Parks, at the Bakery in Atlanta on Monday. D'Antoni Parks is an experimental drummer, songwriter, and actor raised in Noonan, Georgia, now based in New York. We avoided a standoff between the three by allowing each of them a pick for the Georgia playlist.
I'm D'Antoni Parks, otherwise known as Techno Self. And my song is Save Their Souls by Hamilton Bohannon. Hamilton Frederick Bohannon was born in March 1942 and was later known as Bohannon once his musical career took off. The multi-skilled artist was a percussionist, band leader, songwriter, and record producer, and was to become one of the leading figures in 1970s funk and disco music. Is at the center of a few different genres, including soul, pre-hip-hop, and funk. Hamilton Bohannon is also my relative. Been a major influence on my musical career.
Like a puppy on a trampoline.
What do you mean? like a puppy. I'm Dave Nelson with Nelson Patton, and my song is What Do You Mean by Vic Chestnut. The song was released in 2005 on the album Ghetto Bells. Incidentally, the cover features Vic posing next to a trombone, which I found interesting since I'm a trombone player.
Bewildered.
We heard you laughing.
What do you mean?
We heard you laughing.
What do you mean?
I love how simple and vulnerable it sounds in the beginning, with just Vic and his acoustic guitar and singing call and response with the beautiful female vocal duo. The first half of the song kind of continues in this simple folk style. Then you get to a bridge where he does a call and response with the female vocalist. I hope so, we know so, I hope so, we know so, I hope so. And then boom, the rest of the band comes in featuring Bill Frisell with a huge, lush electric guitar soundscape that just fills the entire space and scoops you up and takes you on this emotional ride.
I hope so.
After reveling in this for a minute, he finishes out the song, like a salmon headed up a stream, what do you mean? Ambivalent. We heard you whistling, what do you mean? Contentment. And the overall feeling of this song is very much content. It makes you feel like you've been on a journey with him. And for me, it just made me want to listen to the song over and over again.
Like a salmon headed up a stream.
What do you mean?
Like a salmon headed up a stream.
I was introduced to this song about 10 years ago when my friend Dan Nettles gave me a mixtape of some of his favorite music from Athens, Georgia. I was living in New York City at the time, and that playlist very much became a soundtrack for me during this period. I remember listening to it quite a bit on the subway, but this song in particular really stood out as a favorite. So that's my song, What Do You Mean by Vic Chestnut.
Hey, my name is Marlon Patton, and I'm one half of the experimental duo Nelson Patton. I play drums and Moog bass synth pedals with my foot. My pick for the Georgia playlist is none other than Georgia's own James Brown. Is Cold Sweat, and the version is actually from a very important concert in 1968 at the Boston Garden. It was the day after Dr. Martin Luther King was assassinated, and this concert was put on to try and help bring the community together instead of deadly riots taking place. So it's a super important historical concert. The band is just on fire.
Quiet, kid!
Concert was given to me by a really good friend of mine named Ryan Waters, and I wore it out. I was amazed at this unachievable level of tightness that these guys were at. I was blown away by the sheer force of this band and the energy and stage presence of James Brown. Being a drummer, I'm like immediately drawn to Clyde Stubblefield's groove on this track. Underlying motion that's just propelling it forward the whole time while he's absolutely cracking the snare drum. Clyde is such a huge influence. It's one thing to transcribe him and try to match his feel and his feeling and learn his grooves, but it's a whole other thing to put yourself in the shoes of somebody that was doing this for the very first time and innovating and coming up with these grooves that had never been done before.
Nelson Patton and D'Antoni Parks perform at the Bakery on Monday. That's the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday. Details at gpbnews.org. And if you're searching for new music, Larry Harris Jr. is an Atlanta rapper who goes by Black Bobby. He's also an activist and mental health advocate. His new album, Downloading Alchemist, describes his passions for Atlanta, romance, and music.
Hello, my name is Larry Harris Jr. I perform as Black Bobby around Atlanta. I'm an MC from Washington, D.C. originally, and I love being in Atlanta. Yep, 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 yep. It's your boy Black Bob. Black Bobby is actually a name I borrowed from Robert Kennedy when I was at Harvard studying for my master's. I met a member of the Kennedy family who told me that they called Robert Black Bobby because he was the closest to black people and cared the most about black people. And I just thought that was a dope name. So I stole it and made it my own for hip hop. But I prefer Dos Equis, most interesting man. You know that be my rappy. Used to rock the crummy. I was kind of looking preppy. What can I say, bro? I was trying to slay, bro. High class chicks like a rolling day. Okay, so the first song I want to talk about is On My Atlanta Sh-, which is the first song on Downloading Alchemist. You know, that song came together. First of all, I heard the beat and immediately fell in love with it. It's just an amazing beat. It makes me want to dance and party and two-step and all of that. And then I wanted to write lyrics on it. You know, when I was in Miami, one of the things that people really liked about my music was that I connected a lot with local Miami things. So I wanted to connect with local Atlanta things in my music on that song. So I wrote about the things that get me excited to get out of bed in the morning in Atlanta, like Croc Street Market and the High Museum, just things that I really love to participate in and enjoy and see around the city. I'll be at Cross Street Market with a little honey, checking out the buns, talking about Susie Sue's. Now I'll be out in Emin wearing all my freshest shoes, shopping at Wish, I'm my money, yeah, too. You know, all my chicks got the finest head, too. I think I love it here, flirting with the public here. This the kind of beat where you can bring the public in, whether Indy or a Dem or Republican.
Well, what draws me to Croc Street Market, first of all, is that I live in the area. I live in Edgewood. Great food. Bao buns are one of my favorite meals. So I'd love to go any place where I can get some good food and sit down and enjoy the scenery and people watch. I like people watching. So Croc Street Market is a fantastic innovation here in Atlanta, and I'm glad that it's close to my apartment. Atlanta has definitely influenced my music because I write about my life. So the things that I experience here in Atlanta make it into my music. I rap about the places I go and the people I meet and the experiences I have with people in Atlanta. And it all permeates through my music.
At the High Museum, hitting on my vape, looking fly, you see him. I'm a East Atlanta Roma.
I love the High Museum. I've been there several times. First of all, I love their commitment to diversity. I love seeing the sneaker display that they had there. When I went to the High Museum to see the great sneakers that they had on display and the videos that they played about sneaker culture. And also, they had some Basquiat's on display when I was there. Also, they've had some Harvard alumni events there that I've been to. I just love the High Museum because it's such a resource in Atlanta, and art museums are a great place not only to be inspired by culture and art, but also just to spend some time on a day where you don't necessarily have a ton going on.
Checking out the buns, talk about Susie Sue's. Now be out in Emin wearing all my freshest.
This is smooth. Yeah. I guess I want to talk about something that's important to me. And that subject is women. I guess I'm just a hopeless romantic. Yeah. So the next song I chose is Hopeless Romantic, which describes me to a T. I think ever since I was a little kid, I've had romantic flirtations with women and have been a big fan of women all of my life. And I wanted to write a song that really put a spotlight on my relationship with women. You know, one of the things I don't do on my records is demean women. I never use foul language about women or talk about violence against women or any of that. And I wanted to try to set an example on a song like Hopeless Romantic, where I'm talking about women, but I'm doing it in a playful and positive way. And it gives me a chance to really express how I feel about the people in my life who have contributed so much.
It's like the dopest love. You can have me for as long as we both loving us. I gotta know, can I really put my trust in you? I've been around the block, baby, this is nothing new. This little girl.
I want women that listen to Hopeless Romantic to understand that, you know, I care a lot about my relationships with women ever since I was a little boy, starting with my mother and on to the women that have been a part of my life throughout the rest of it. I pay attention, you know, I respect you, and I love you. So, I want women to come to my shows. One thing that I don't want is to be in a room full of sweaty men making hip hop. So, I try to have songs that appeal to women on my records.
We both loving us. I gotta know, can I really put my trust in you? I've been around the block, baby, this is nothing new. I heard the newest, it's like the dopest love. You can have me for as long, we both love.
If you want to pass along that music or any of today's show, hit the programs tab for On Second Thought at gppnews.org. And that's where you can subscribe to the OST podcast, so you will never miss a trick. Elena Rivera, Leighton Rowell, The Raven Taylor, and Amelia Brock produced the show. Don Smith, our Dean of Grammar, and Amy Kiley is senior producer. Today, we bid a fond farewell to Tyler Morris. He has been our engineer, chief yogi, and has saved more than one day with a quick remix. Tyler is going to pursue his musical career full time, and we look forward to watching where it leads and to the day he pops up on a Georgia playlist. Thank you so much, Tyler, and happy trails. I'm Virginia Prescott. Have a terrific holiday weekend. This is On Second Thought.